Let's talk. John Brown. The wilderness years. Newcastle United, 1978 to 1984. What was it like to be a diehard Newcastle fan stuck in the void between the club's Wembley glory days of the 1950s and its dazzling entertainers of the 90s? Well, this new gripping tome tells the story of a young Newcastle United fan who, I believe, said that he would buy his parents and grandparents a bungalow when he eventually played for Newcastle United. I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Gary Shepherd, author of The Wilderness Years. Gary, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning to you.
And so, yeah, tell me a little bit. I mean, I'm going to say, whereabouts are you today? Are you up in Newcastle today?
No, I've lived away from the northeast virtually my entire adult life. Just moved away from work in 1987, right, and have not been back in the area. But yeah, the wilderness years is about the formative years before that, and the burden that we bear as a Newcastle United fan.
To those who don't know, Newcastle, I mean, football in Newcastle is a religion. And I'm going to tell this story before we get started, because I used to work as an editor for a property magazine. And in the 90s, I went up to Newcastle for the first time, you know, on the train, and I stopped and I got off and I got in a black cab, you know, taxi. And I, you know, the Geordies, he's chatting away to me. I said, this is my first time in Newcastle, at which point he stopped the meter and drove me to St. James Park and went, there it is, lad. And then he put the new pack on and we kept on to my journey. And you know, for those soft southerners among us, that doesn't happen if you rock up and, you know, with a Crystal Palace fan or something like that.
No, I think that's a good way to sum up the attitude of that part of the Northeast. Let's not include everybody in the Northeast, but the Newcastle side of it, very much so. I think everybody in the city is an ambassador for the club. I was up in Newcastle on Saturday on a flying visit in connection with my book, and just to see people walking around in black and white shirts while the team is down at Aston Villa brought it all back, really. And it's very much the cathedral on the top of the hill, the stadium there that you see for miles around in all directions. Just shows that the influence physically, geographically, and emotionally that it has on the region.
And also the thing is, because now Newcastle have been in the Premier League for a while now, but when they weren't, it was their absence that really hit hard, because there's the English Football League, and there wasn't this powerhouse. And I know Sunderland and Middlesbrough fans will be throwing things at the wireless by now, but you need Newcastle, because it is part of the folklore of the game. Let's kick off in the, see what I did there? Let's kick off in the 50s, for example, when they are absolutely one of the powerhouses.
Yeah, it was a team that I think inconsistency has been a central part of Newcastle United. So you get used to taking the rough with the smooth. But in the early 50s, three Wembley appearances in 5 years. A couple of those seasons doing well in the league, and others where the FA Cup became the priority quite early on and league form suffered. But that was the generation of fans that my dad belongs to, 50-odd thousand in home games, a mostly uncovered stadium. If you can imagine, it might be all right in parts of Mediterranean Europe and Southern Europe. It's not great in the northern outpost of English football, but massive crowds, massive passion, and a team that did very well for a few years at the start of the 50s, a little few glimpses in the 60s after a spell in the second division, and then came into the generation that I was brought into and started going to that seemed a million miles away.
Yeah, but you see, I've been out in the big market on a Friday night, and you know, I've seen guys wandering around in t-shirts and beautiful women wandering around in very little clothing, which was, I was highly shocked and appalled, I must admit. I was running around trying to put coats around them, but you know, so an open roof stadium, it wasn't really a problem for the Geordies, was it? Let's face it.
No, not an issue. You could tell who'd been to the ground, because they had wet shoulders, but the rest of them were bone dry because they were packed in pretty tightly for big games. But yeah, I was in the big market on Saturday. I watched the second half of the Aston Villa Newcastle game in the big market before getting a train back down south.
Fantastic. So this particular period, I mean, it's called the wilderness years, because we have those years of sort of Keegan and Malcolm and all that sort of thing in the early 70s, and it seems inconceivable that they're going to drop out of the old first division. Kids ask your parents. All matches kicking off at the same time. Everyone watching the Saturday on the BBC going West Brom 3, etc. But so what is the starting point for your book then? For the Wilderness Years.
Yeah, the starting point for me, it's first of all, it's not an analytical view of six seasons out the top division. It's that generation of lads. I was 11, 12 when Newcastle were relegated. Only Newcastle could sell Malcolm MacDonald and qualify for Europe in the same year, and then get relegated and play in Europe in the following year with 22 points, which was real hiding. It was a hideous and embarrassing relegation. So in 1978, I'm at the age where I'm allowed to go with a bunch of friends rather than with friends and family. And we were the guys who were on our way into the ground, just as several thousand others were on their way down the hill trying to avoid the football at all costs. Attendance is down to 11,000, 12,000, probably regularly 15,000 to 17,000. It's the story really of it's your team, it's our team. It doesn't really matter what the results are on the pitch when you're 11, 12 year old. You want to be in the middle of it. You feel grown up because you're part of it.
Yeah.
A little bit more grown up than you would be if you were going with your dad. So you're with a bunch of mates, and it was, and also at that stage, there was so little football on TV, match of the day on a Saturday night. We had Shoot the Tyne Tees regional programme on Sunday, but whatever you did on a Saturday, you had to keep your conversation going for the full week. So if you weren't at the match day, you were outside quite a lot of those conversations about players and situations and crowd noise and what was going around, but it was just that evolution of a 11, 12, 13-year-old through some pretty dark times for football in general, but for Newcastle especially.
I'm thinking we're exactly the same generation, okay? So I'm just thinking of trying to explain to a 12-year-old now who probably plays, you know, EA Sports, you know, on his PlayStation and has his team and the whole thing, and you know, has got the merch. You know, a whole range from a cup holder to a, you know, iPad thing or whatever. You know, I mean, merch in our day, you know, you got a shirt, that was it. And the shirt kind of went, you know, the shirt sort of stood you for about six or seven seasons. None of this name on the back. You know, and also, I'm just thinking, you'd probably get done for child abuse now if you took an 11-year-old to a Newcastle match back in the day, because we're not talking sort of fan villages or seater stadiums and family, you know, family friendly cuisine and safe zones, are we, Gary?
No, it was very basic. Football was basic everywhere you went. But at Newcastle at that stage, it's a largely concrete ball with one wooden stand and one concrete stand, the new stand that was built in 1972. So it was only 6 or 7 years old when I became a regular there. Outside was pretty rough. You had some far-right campaigners outside because they thought they had a captive audience at the football. There's one pub, a very famous pub, the Strawberry, which is on one corner of the Gallagher end at Newcastle, which these days is a focal point. In those days, you scuttled past pretty quickly. There weren't the kind of people that you were getting a conversation with who were heading into the pub at 1:30 on a Saturday. Could be rough. Away fans fancy their chances from time to time. You would see a little bit of trouble here and there. In the ground, there would be some home fans in the away end. They've got kicked out, some away fans in the home end who fancied their chances. It was, there's no disguising, it was a bit rough, but never, ever felt any fear or scared of anything. My mentality was, nobody's going to fight a 13-year-old except another 13-year-old. So as long as you don't bump into the one of them in the away end, you're all right. But there were some flashpoints in the game. Generally, 5 minutes, police are in, sorted out. The fans get walk of shame around the edge of the pitch, and they're either thrown in the opposite end or they're thrown in the charge room or a police van outside. Used to see the vans parked along the main roads outside, and that was it. It was flashpoints, but although it sounds pretty basic, was never ever scared. My parents were never worried that something was going to happen to me in the middle of a football match.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And they couldn't have got you on the mobile because they didn't have mobiles back in the day. But also, but also, it's that whole, because it's not Caesar Stadium, is it? I mean, were you sitting? Were you standing? What was your, what was the, what no. were you normally doing?
St. James's Park, I think, had 4,000 seats at 36,000 capacity. And even when they built the new stand in the early 70s, they'd only added a couple of thousand more. Basically, you had three large paddocks in front of one side, in front of the wooden stand. You had the old Leasers End, which was the home end, but got bulldozed at the relegation season to be redeveloped. It took about 15 years to redevelop it. We just had a blank wall and some concrete steps in front of it, while everybody was sent from there to the Gallagher End, which had previously been a mixed end, but that by default came the home end. Open terrace, concrete steps, concrete bollards, absolute home sweet home. We loved it.
Because it's the thing. I mean, you can say, oh, well, you know, it was basic, but it's a community, isn't it? I mean, it is. Yeah. It's real fans. People didn't go to football matches for the experience. I mean, when I went to Barcelona to see Barcelona against Real Madrid a while back now, I was struck by the number of people who were there, if you like, doing sports tourism. So they had bought all this, you know, they sat there, they're in the seats, they got the scarves, you know, they got the thing, they were doing the selfies, and it was like, yeah, you know, a lot of them come from Japan or China. You know, it's a sports tourism thing. Oh, darling, we're going to Barcelona. Wouldn't it be wonderful to watch a match? That didn't happen. That did not happen in the 70s and early 80s.
No, there were no postcards sent from the away end at St. James's Park, that's for sure. But it was what everything revolved around. Your week revolved around that Saturday afternoon. Yeah. Obviously, everybody kicked off at 3 o'clock, added to it. But it's just a special sense of community that you don't get if you've got a numbered ticket and a numbered seat. It's all very orderly. You walk in and you follow until you get a match to whatever's printed on your ticket. When there's a terrace, we used to stand in a particular place, but if there was already somebody standing there, you moved along a bit. Or if there was a nutcase who came to stand next to you, you moved a few steps to one side or further back. Occasionally we'd go, oh, let's go in the corner. Well, I haven't been there for ages. But a much bigger sense of community. If you get squashed, if you get pushed over, if you stumble in that kind of, you've seen the limbs videos of people in the home end at various grounds. But if you missed your step, somebody caught you and put you back up. It was very much a case of looking after each other, even in the excitement and the pandemonium of a goal and some hot heads in there as well. Everybody did look after each other in a way that you don't really need when you've got a numbered seat.
So the connection between yourselves and the players as well, because, you know, at that time, you know, I did an interview a couple of years last year about Leeds and the fact that we could go down and you'd find Gordon Strachan in the pub afterwards. You know, there wasn't that. Now, I'm not saying that you were hanging out with the players, but there is, you know, in a world now where most of the sub benches are deciding which Bentley they should take home after the match and if they haven't played, you know, there is that direct contact, because a lot of them have been in the club for more than one season, and it is before big name foreign transfers are coming in. It's mainly, you know, but obviously it's got Scots players, so they sort of count a bit, though they speak a different language. But you guys being Geordies are sort of the halfway house between our soft southerners, if you like, and the Celts.
Yeah, very much enjoy the Scottish influence at Newcastle, a lot of them over the years. But we used to, if we were there early enough, you'd walk around to the old stand side and the players parked in the car park there.
Yeah.
While you were queuing for a ticket, one of the players would drive past you to park his XR3 or his Ford Fiesta. And occasionally, if you didn't really carry a pen very often, but somebody might have had a pen, you had your programme, and you just walk across to a player on his way in and say, can you sign this? Sign your programme or your ticket. The players were, I'd say they were a breed apart, only that we all wanted to be one of them, but there were obviously only 25 players in a squad who'd actually made that far. That made them a breed apart, but they lived in similar circumstances to most of them. Newcastle in that era signed non-league players. Alan Shoulder was a real hit in the 78-79 part of the wilderness years. He came from a coal mining background. He worked for the National Coal Board until his mid-20s, played for Blyth Spartans in a famous cup season, joined Newcastle, became one of the best players. It showed one thing, it showed how good part-time football was, but it also showed how desperate times had been when one of your star players 6 weeks earlier had been working down the pit, and now he was part of a good strike force. So you saw the players a lot more. They earned more money than our dads did, but not 10 times more, or not 100 times more.
And like every young schoolboy who's kicking a ball against the wall and getting it back, and you see it there, and you're in your mind, you're scoring the winner at Wembley. You know, you too, didn't we all have dreams of playing for our team? You're no different. And the great thing about you did you keep a scrapbook of your chart? Hopefully your chart. I mean, you know, your rise up through the ranks. Tell me a little bit about that.
I've kept scrapbooks and notebooks and tickets and programmes and everything right the way through. I used to keep cuttings out of the Evening Chronicle and the Pink on a Saturday night from the Newcastle games. But I did have a separate one that was the cuttings of match reports of the games that I played in for school and boys' clubs and things like that. Didn't give myself man of the match every week.
Right.
Sometimes I would actually share that with some others. But The dream was always somebody somewhere is going to open a curtain and see us playing on the welfare and think, yeah, he's the lad that could solve Newcastle's problems. And probably I wasn't too far away at that age because it was such a poor Newcastle team.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that shows remarkable foresight to think, you know, one day when I am the Pelly of the North, they will want these scrapbooks to describe my humble beginnings, Gary. I think that's admirable, sir.
Yeah, humble. That's humble.
What's it like? I mean, you've gone from FA Cups and League Cups and whatever then, 78, it all comes crashing down and you find yourself in this old second division, which presumably that's playing, I don't know, Port Vale, which, with the greatest respect to the Potters, or not, they're not even the Potters, Robbie Williams' favourite team, ha. Did the romance go out of the game for you? Or is this the case, once again, is that, you know, we're going to go up, this isn't T.S. Eliot in the Wasteland quite yet?
Yeah, I think the romance part of it's probably for people who were older than us. We just wanted to be in it, and it didn't matter whether you were playing against Bristol Rovers or Liverpool. You just want to be on the inside. But there was, at that stage, 78, 79, 80, there were quite a number of really small town clubs in that division. You've suddenly got Newcastle playing against Shrewsbury and Cambridge, oh. Bristol Rovers, Orient, and not being disrespectful to any of them, but they were getting 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 for a home game. Newcastle descend, double that. I think up until 1981, the home club shared the gate with the away club. So those clubs would love coming up to Newcastle, even if they were badly supported at 13,000 or 14,000. It was a lot more than they were getting in. So there was that. We didn't have the dark humour part of it because we weren't old enough to think of in gallows humour terms. Yeah. I've done that a lot since, but at that stage, it was just, it's our team. We want them to beat whoever's in front of them. I don't care whether it's a top division team or a second division team. But the stark reality that even then, as a 13-year-old realised, was just how quickly the rest of the club seemed to accept that it was a second division team. And that was the bit that probably brought the cynic out in me a bit earlier than it needed to be honest. Started buying players from lower divisions who were never going to go up with Newcastle. They'd be all right in the second division, but they weren't going to be promotion winners. And it just seemed like ambition had gone and the club were content to be in the second division in the knowledge that at some stage we'll get promoted with some of these players, or we'll bring somebody through of our own. There didn't seem to be that great investment and commitment to getting promoted from higher up in the club.
I'm just thinking of the reaction of Leighton Orient, because I played Barry Hearn on the intro to this. I mean, when Newcastle turned up at Leighton Orient, that must have been a sight. I mean, he must have been rubbing his hands with glee because of the cash till, you know, but at the same time, quite a daunting prospect for the...
I think Orient had had a cup run as well, didn't they? Was it 78 on the season in the second division? But those kind of clubs, they must have absolutely loved it. And if I'd been older, I would probably really enjoyed the fact that you got a day at Orient, because you're only going to do it once or twice, because in a couple of seasons' time, you'll be back against the Leeds and Man United and Liverpool and Everton's and Arsenal's of this world. But at that stage, being just a home fan, it was a bit of a novelty when you saw somebody like that. You obviously didn't see them on Match of the Day, so you didn't know their players like you can now, where Football League has a TV deal and there's wall-to-wall news every day.
Yeah.
In those days, your one chance was a match of the day, and then perhaps your regional programme on a Sunday afternoon probably got to know one or two names of a team like an Orient or a Shrewsbury or a Cambridge. And it was, yeah, a different world.
Indeed. What was that final season then? Did you dare to dream as it looked like you were going to be promoted? I mean, this is you know, it is the promised land. I mean, but so many teams have got there. And this is before playoffs and Wembley cash cows and the whole thing. So it's old school. But you must have been, as Ferguson would call it, must have been squeaky bum time at some point during that rise.
Yeah, the wilderness years, the book covers six seasons, but really it's the first four are the wilderness, because then the miracle happened that Kevin Keegan, England captain, double European player of the year, decided to leave Southampton and join a team in the second division. The immediate reaction was, all right, we'll just turn up and we'll get promoted. We've got Kevin Keegan. It yeah. didn't work like that. We actually struggled quite a bit in his first season in 82-83. He finished fifth, but well off the pace. And then you start thinking, he's getting 31, 32-year-old here. How many chances are we going to have to get promoted? And the second season of Keegan, 83-84, that was an incredible season. Suddenly you get a forward line of Keegan, Peter Beardsley and Chris Waddle. That is a match for most first division strike forces, never mind second division, and still didn't have it all our own way. Went up in third place.
Yeah.
Chelsea and Sheffield Wednesday went up ahead of Newcastle, and we were just ahead of Manchester City and Grimsby. So that's an indication of the life of the second division in those days. But as that season went on, just thinking it's the most entertaining team that probably most of us had seen at that stage. Gold dust up front, we really need to get promoted because this is it. And then Kevin Keegan announced he would retire at the end of that season after an FA Cup game against Liverpool. He said, I need to go out as high as I can. This is my last season. That must have put an awful lot of pressure on in the dressing room.
Yeah.
And as fans, that's the bit where every single week you were willing the team to get through another week. Let's stay in third place. Let's get to second place, whatever, because it was going to be a fairy tale to get promoted in Keegan's last season. I don't think that was particularly squeaky bum time, because I think, thinking back of it, we were always round about top five.
Yeah.
We beat Manchester City 5-0 early on with a hat-trick from Peter Beardsley. So you think, oh, Man City aren't going to catch us. Are Grimsby really going to go up behind ahead of Newcastle United? They had a good team at that stage. But it was more about counting down the weeks. Couldn't wait for the season to end once you get into third. I don't care now about second or first. We just need to be in the top three. When there's no playoffs to go for, there's no margin of error. A couple of big results, Portsmouth away, another Beardsley-inspired game, the Derby game, Derby County game was massive. And then on the last day, it was a lap of honour, really, because it was a game against Brighton, and Newcastle scored three, and Keegan, Beardsley and Waddle all scored and all had a hand in their teammates' goals. So it was all written by then, and a proper celebration then.
What was the outpouring of emotion like? I mean, did we do tears back in the early 80s? I mean, did we have group hugs?
Yeah, as a 17-year-old, I think the furthest thing away from my mind was probably hugging the lads that I'd been to the games with. But at that stage, a massive amount of relief.
Yeah.
And nobody thought about the consequences. Nobody was thinking about what would happen the following season in the first division. It was just about getting there. But the emotion, the absolute elation of that Brighton game, that was the last game of the season. And then we had Keegan's farewell game, which is a glorified testimonial game against Liverpool, when Keegan left in a helicopter from the middle of the pitch. Nobody else would dare to do that. That was Kevin Keegan. It wasn't showing off. It was just it was something a bit different. And he'd always done things slightly differently to other players around. But that showed the fact that Liverpool came to play in a game at the end of a season, when they're at the height of the powers, showed that it was something a little bit different. And that carried us through Unfortunately, during that season, obviously Keegan retires at the end. Arthur Cox, the manager, left during the summer. There were quite a few implications as time went on, but really, it's all right. We're in the first division. We'll worry about the rest of it after we get there.
And also, of course, not forgetting, you know, the movie star looks of Peter Beardsley. I mean, let's face it. I mean, if you're looking for a screen idol, I mean, but Waddle, Beardsley and Keegan, that is a strike force and a half.
Yeah, absolutely incredible for the three of them to be together. And you wonder how much Chris Waddle and Peter Beardsley improved and developed as individuals. Having Kevin Keegan train alongside them every day must have been absolutely incredible. And he identified Peter Beardsley as the heir apparent to his shirt. And Beardsley, arguably Newcastle's greatest ever player in his two spells.
Yeah.
Sadly, Newcastle sold Beardsley, sold Waddle, sold Paul Gascoigne, who came just after that.
Yeah.
And was well known for selling its best players. It's not a situation we're in now, of course. Newcastle would never sell the best players
but of course,
have them coveted elsewhere.
I'm going to run out of time, Gary. If people, the book is called The World, what are you hoping that people take from the book then, The Wilderness Years?
One of the things they've taken from the feedback is you enjoy what you've got, because it could be a lot worse. Moaning at the minute that we might lose some good players to other Premier League clubs. We've lost players before. We've done pretty well, and the world continues without certain individuals. But I think more than that, it's a celebration of match day. That was my reason for writing it. Before those days have disappeared forever, in a completely different context the world is now, it's about celebration.
The book is called The Wilderness Years. Gary, thank you so much for your time today.
Privilege, thank you.